Hello, and welcome back to a brand new episode of the Silmarillion Film Project. I'm your co-host, Dave Kale. And this episode, we will be talking about the Avari and the Unwilling. But thankfully, you're not unwilling. You're here. You're listening, either live or maybe later after downloading this thing, possibly. But nonetheless, you're willing.
Excellent.
And as you can hear, I am joined, as always, by the Tolkien maven Trish Lambert and the Tolkien professor Corey Olsen.
Good morning, everybody.
Absolutely. You guys are also willing, right?
That's right.
Oh, willing.
Very willing.
And able.
That's right. Well, not willing anyway.
And enthusiastic.
That's right. Enthusiastically willing. And we can go as far as that. Excellent.
I paused on the idea of being ready, you know, as in wedding, willing, and able. I'm not sure about ready, but we'll see.
Right. Exactly. Exactly.
Is there like a little known subgroup of the elves that Tolkien introduces somewhere later that correspond to the enthusiastic?
Or like the willing but unprepared, right? Yeah. 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 Excellent. Okay, well, before we start, quick announcement, or sort of re-announcement, or reminder, we are now 1 month away from Midmoot, from the Mid-Atlantic Speculative Fiction Symposium at the University of Maryland, the day after Bilbo and Frodo's birthday. And we have a really great crowd forming. Verlyn Flieger is going to be there talking about her new Tolkien project, which is the soon-to-be-released edition of The Lay of Ao True and Itrune that she is currently working on. And we're also going to have a presentation by Janet Croft, which would be really cool. And lots of the list of presentations that people are going to be giving looks really awesome. And we have a good crowd coming. We've already actually had to like go back to our venue for the banquet and like expand the room because we have even more people coming than we thought. So it looks like it's going to be bigger than last year, and it's going to be really fun. So I'm definitely planning to be there, and I would love to get a chance to meet anybody who can make it. I know that not everyone can make it here, and we still hope someday to have regional events in other places. But for now, we do have this, and I look forward to seeing anybody who can come and join us at the University of Maryland campus on the day after Bilbo and Frodo's birthday. So I just encourage you to look that up. You can find information on that either in the Mythgard.org website or on the SignumUniversity.org website. With the registration links there. So just a reminder to do that. Also, the semester starts on Monday at Signum. So especially those of you who might think about auditing Dimitra Femi's awesome new class that she's offering this term on folklore and the adaptation of the sort of the development of folklore motifs and their adaptation into modern storytelling and film with a special focus on vampire stories. It should be a really, really cool class. So I encourage you to get into that because Dimitra Femi is awesome. So still plenty of time to sign up to audit there. And even if you want to sign up and like apply to the program and take for credit, we could probably still get you. It's getting a little last minute for that, but we could probably still squeeze you in. All right, those are my announcements this week. Let us start talking. So I want to talk about. So at the beginning, of course, usually we go back and address some like things, responses that people had to what we were discussing last time. And the first thing that I want to focus on today, as we talk about that, are comments about the frame narrative. This is especially Philip Menzies very helpfully made a very long post talking about the frame and sort of making some objections and some suggestions. I'm going to object to his objection, but I like a lot of his suggestions. His objection was that we were kind of pulling back the curtain too quickly. That I was emphasizing, we really need to get to Arwen's main question of whether or not to go into the West, you know, like whether or not going into the West is a good idea or a bad idea, as part of the frame of episode three. And he was suggesting that we really want to save that and not go there in episode three. The main thing that I would say in response to that, I don't disagree with the concept of sort of stretching that out a little bit, and I particularly love Philip's overall concept of having particularly the story of Celebrian be sort of revealed more and more gradually. I'm perfectly willing to do that. But I still think it's really important that we pose the question. Right? We don't have to give the answer, right? We don't have to show what Arwen decides to do or where she comes out of it. But we clearly, I think, we clearly need to be making sure the question is really on the table at the very beginning. And that's really all that I was suggesting about the frame in as far as, you know, Arwen's question in the frame of episode three. And I can't see any better place to do that than the debate, right? When the elves are deciding, like, do we go into the West or do we stay in Middle Earth? There it is. Like, the question is on the table inside the frame, right? In our first age story. So why on earth would we not talk about that? Would we not have that come up in the frame, since that's going to be Arwen's question? And it can be raised as a non-trivial question, and there are different ways of looking at it, and Celeborn and Galadriel are both going to have a lot to say about this question. So again, it's not like we're going to be just coming to the end and resolving the thing in the frame, but I do think it would be really good for us to be making sure that that issue is plain, because it's going to underlie the whole thing. I mean, we have the great debate at Quivienin in episode three. By the time we get to the end, we're going to have the unrest of the Noldor by the end of season two. And there are going to be people whispering, well, like Melkor whispering, but other people spreading around Melkor's whispering about, hey, like the elves have gotten gypped, right? They've been robbed. And they're being kept in thraldom. It was a bad idea for them to come. Where they really belong is Middle Earth, and they're getting deprived of their inheritance. That's going to be part of the story that's circulating around the Noldor during the time of their unrest after the unchaining of Melkor. So this question is going to be, you know, and then ultimately we're going to be, you know, obviously having the departure of the Noldor at the beginning of season three. So this question is a major arc level question for both the content, you know, the first age content of season two, as well as the frame. And it seems to me we clearly need to have that be, so that's why I think episode three should be the one where this question really comes out and Arwen finally like up and asks the question that's really burning in her mind. What we can then go on and reveal is a more of the background. Right, it's totally fine. Again, we'd like to learn more of the Celebrian story. We said last time we should probably, you know, we should save Elladan and Elro here, and we didn't need to introduce them right away there in episode three. So yeah, by all means, bring in the twins' perspective and their experience with their mom. Let's bring in other things, and let's finally let's have not until the very end does she, you know, come to a conclusion that she's sort of willing to live with for the moment. Of course, it's going to be impacted by the whole Aragorn situation in season five. But anyway, I think to me it fits so clearly in the arc, and it's really important, I think, for us to introduce the question. So that's what I want. To defend and to clarify what I would assert about the importance of the frame there and why I would definitely not want to push that issue back. And I don't really think it's going to be revealing too much if we do it that way.
Yeah, and I'm not sure. I mean, the dilemma over what to cover the rest of the season if we reveal this, or if we tackle this in the third episode, I don't think it would be necessarily different if we delayed this till later. Then there's a question of what to cover before until then. So
right.
I think this works. Like we telegraph that this is the central issue, which
yes.
It makes sense to, as you say, it makes sense to do it now because. Mm-hmm. because we're already tackling this in our main story. Mm-hmm. So, you know, then we can just fill out details and give other characters, give some background. So, like, show, you know, so we say, we show that this is a dilemma, and then we spend the rest of the season explaining why. Like, why is this even a thing?
Right, exactly. I mean, that's a big part of what the frame does, or what the main story, you know, is sort of posing, right? Is to sort of show this whole, the real terms of this, you know, the going, both the going to Valinor and the staying in Middle-earth options are going to be explored over the course of the story.
Seems reasonable.
Yeah. Good. Now, but the other thing I said, though, I really do like some of the suggestions that he makes. Philip was describing going through and looking at the Tale of Years, which I agree. I really like doing that, too, and kind of thinking about, you know, making sure we're kind of remembering connections and stuff to make. And we've brought up this issue before, like the fact that that Celebrian's departure coincides with the ride of the Rohirrim, you know, with the ride of Eorl the Young from the north to the field of Celebrant. And I brought that up before in the context of remembering the time distance that we have from the chronological point of our frame, which is chronologically after the frame of season one. And, you know, basically her mom has been gone for hundreds of years already, right? She's been gone for 500 years or 400 years in change. So that's the context in which, you know, we brought up that historical fact before. But Philip went on to make a lovely point about a potential story for Galadriel. Essentially the significance of the fact that Galadriel was, you know, according to the Unfinished Tales story, Galadriel was there struggling with Dol Guldur and assisting the ride of the Rohirrim at the same time that her daughter was sailing for Valinor. And that seems to actually kind of represent a choice that Galadriel has made too, which I think is a really interesting thing to explore, and that would be really fun. Yeah. And of course, it raised the possibility, the very delightful possibility of basically depicting, at least in part, and from a distance, the ride of Eorl the Young from Galadriel's point of view, you know, to kind of tell that story within the frame, though we get this, like, frame story within the frame before we get to the frame story inside the frame, which could, you know, potentially be confusing. But anyway, To actually do that, so that when we come back and tell the story later on, like 15 years from now, when we get to that point chronologically, you know, we would be doing again kind of the same thing we did with the war to begin all wars at the end of season one, where we show the thing from like, you know, from the god's perspective, and then from the mortal perspective, and we can be basically sort of doing the same thing. We show that ride from as part of this, you know, so essentially we show it in a way that depicts essentially Eorl the Young and his riders as like a pawn on the board in the struggle between Galadriel and Sauron, right? And then we show it again from the point of view of Eorl the Young and his riders, who obviously don't think about it and see it quite the same way, and who themselves are not even entirely sure that the elves are the good guys, obviously, as we know. So anyway, I think that's a really fascinating concept, and I'd like to come back to that later on in the frame when we get closer to that. He was also pointing out that another thing that happens chronologically at around the time of the frame is, again, chronologically, right after The Hobbit, right? Because we were having Bilbo's return through Rivendell on the way home from Erebor near the end, or at the end, of season one. And so Philip was pointing out that, of course, one other thing that's happening and is happening in the general, you know, the general area of Lorien and Mirkwood in that time is Gollum's emerging and, you know, stealing people's babies and terrorizing folks. And so he was suggesting the possibility of, like, maybe Gandalf coming and reporting that this is happening and this be something that could actually be worked in. And I think is also a really interesting suggestion. I'm not sure what we'd want to do with it. I mean, Philip raised the possibility of even having a Frame episode, which has, you know, some people, possibly Arwen herself, going out and trying to help the people, you know, who are being terrorized by the shadow in the night. And I think that actually kind of has a lot of potential. I mean, this doesn't mean we have to turn Arwen into an action figure, but she doesn't have to be an action figure to go out and help folks. And in some ways, actually, I kind of find very appealing the idea. I mean, I think we want to work against this stereotype that the elves and the elf women in particular are just very good at sitting around and doing almost nothing. It's easy to get that impression, right?
Or that it's a choice between sitting around doing nothing or being an action hero.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. I mean, she's Elrond's daughter, right? So presumably going out to, like, you know, in healer mode rather than action hero mode would be a thing she would and could do, right? You know, that would not seem inappropriate, especially if we're going to make, you know, Arwen in the end be leaning towards, like, activist, my place is here in Middle Earth to help to heal its wounds. That would be, you know, this would be an opportunity for, you know, right away. There's, like, you know, there is a shadow again oppressing people, and it could be even kind of like that. We could even make a little small little miniature parallel to the Dark Rider, right? You know, like people vanishing and stuff, and this dark shadow that is causing, that is, you know, so like the fear that has been laid upon these communities, you know, under the eaves of Mirkwood. Could be, you know, be parallel, you know, distantly parallel and on a much smaller scale. But again, like the fear of the elves at Quivienin, with the Dark Rider, but you know, here's something she can go out and do something about this. And Carita, I agree with you. Going out and helping harried people would be a very queenly thing to do. Absolutely, that's exactly I think it would fit with her role to show her caring about people and going out and doing something. Again, without having to make her into an action figure. Plus it also seems a very kind of Gandalfian thing to do, right? To have him come in and be like, here's what's going on in the world outside, and we should go and do something. That seems, you know, and having him coming, like he can't do it himself, right? Because he's got somewhere else, something else to do. But you know, he comes in and asks for assistance. We know he does that kind of thing. So,
that's right. Yep.
So I think that would be good, but that's it. Both of those ideas I really do like, and I think that we can kind of keep them for later on. So actually, okay. So here's a little project. Philip already started this, and I think sort of continuing on Philip's discussion, what I would love to see is sort of like a list of events, even if those events are really discussion topics, but events that we would want to do in the rest of the Frames. Because we've talked about a bunch of things, but I still feel like they're kind of really sort of jumbled in my own mind, and I don't have a really clear sense of how we want to put them together in a clear arc. And of course, we need to be thinking, as Philip was thinking, about their connection with the First Age narrative. So we could sort of make a list of the things, you know, the reveals about Celebrion, the other, you know, again, if we do the Gandalf's visit and the you know, the miniature shadow by the eaves of Mirkwood thing, and if we do the Rite of Eorl the Young thing, there's a lot of stuff. So, anyway, I'd love to start getting that sorted out a little bit. But that sounds like a really good project for the discussion boards to be talking about. Maybe we'll come back to that next time. The other Hey, I have an idea. Let's wait to talk about the frame for this time until we get to the end.
There's a good idea.
How about that? Let's do that. Yeah. Yeah, I was gonna segue to today's frame, but why do that? Why segue when I could postpone? So let's do that. Okay.
That's our battle cry.
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah.
Why segue when we can postpone? Yeah, absolutely.
Tony Meat says, and it's a punt on first down. No. I'm not punting. this is a tactical maneuver.
Well, because we know if we start the frame discussion now, it could actually take up the whole entire time if we let it. So
yes, this is me like reversing tack here because cowardice is always the best policy. You guys are merciless here. Come on,
like reversing tack. So we'll use sailboats racing metaphor instead of football. I like it.
Yeah, so we'll talk about it at the end. I have ideas about it, but they'll make more sense after we've talked about the content of the episode. Because, I mean, at the end of the day, by the way, that seems to me the best and most sensible policy. I mean, obviously our central story is the first stage story, and we don't want to have the frame story driving the first stage story. We want it to be working the other way around. So it's always best to keep in mind the logical progression and the narrative drive and the thematic developments of the first stage story and have those things be the things that kind of tip us off and guide us as we make the frame rather than the other way around. All right. What I want to then go to, I want to pick up on, and this is actually another thing sort of similar to the frame thread. I talked about this at the very, 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 I sort of squeezed this into the very end of last time, and that is the bad guy story arc. Because I still really love this idea of having season two be like the next step forward in Sauron's development. And his journey to the dark side. Because the more I've thought about this, the more sense that it makes to me. We're at serious risk of being very careful about sort of showing the path that Sauron takes to sort of his moment of conversion. But the danger that we were running in our discussions of this last season and our cheerful discussions of like Sauron jumping right into the super secret necromantic orc project. Basically, the risk is just making his conversion completely wholehearted and absolutely sudden, right? You know, so he goes from, you know, slowly and almost reluctantly, but kind of coming around to deciding to side with Melkor, and then all of a sudden he's like torturing people for fun right after that. Like, that doesn't really work. So I think we would want to be a little bit more careful about that. So I really love I'm just all about praising Philip's work here today. But again, this was an idea which was inspired by the musical theme that Philip wrote for Myron in the second season, which is one of melancholy and even regret. You know, it's a really sad theme which emphasizes like the tragedy of what's happening with Myron and the change to him. But I do think we really need to show, okay, so he's shifted his allegiance from Aule to Melkor, but this doesn't mean that, like, he's immediately become, you know, like, completely evil, right? So we need to give a mechanism. How does this guy end up, you know, being, like, the tormentor of the elves and the head of the Orc Project? And I think that the suggestions that were made last time that I touched on very briefly at the end of the last time, to me, I think would really work. And that is the thing ultimately that pushes him over that last frontier is pride, basically, the competition with Gothmog. So he's been, you know, he sort of feels himself to be in command now. What draws him over is his service to Melkor, right? You know, he believes in Melkor's cause and believes that Melkor's cause is right, and that, you know, that he's right and the other Valar are wrong. But again, that's not an evil choice, nor is it a choice to become evil, right? He's got to make that step on his own. And you know, we will see that set up. Like, what attracts him to Melkor's position as opposed to the Valar is his strength, right? So his choice to say, I'm sticking with the guy who's strong and going to get things done, instead of like those like namby-pamby wusses over there in Valinor, is already like showing that he's like on the wrong path, right?
Mm-hmm.
But he still has to kind of own it himself, and take those next steps. But that idea with the basically the power struggle between him and Gothmog, and having that be the thing that ultimately pushes him, as he is, because Gothmog is already over the edge.
Yeah,
right.
I agree. I think it's a great mechanism to move his downfall along. Makes sense.
Yeah, Gothmog can be like pure ruthless power. And use of power. I mean, the Balrogs are thugs. We've talked about this now. Like, basically, the Balrogs are thugs, and Gothmog needn't be a very subtle operator, right? Myron is the subtle one, and knows that he is the subtle one, right? He sees, and probably on very good grounds, that he and not Gothmog should be running the operation while Melkor is in prison. Probably both Gothmog and Sauron believe, or Myron, as we should still call him, both of them presumably still believe that Melkor is going to return, right? That he's going to, you know, the Valar are not going to be able to hold him forever. So they, all of them are sort of kind of holding the place, and wanting to continue Morgoth's work. Excuse me. Did I call him Morgoth? That was an accident. I meant Melkor, because he's not Morgoth yet.
I would imagine that Myron would treat Gothmog with very thinly veiled contempt.
Mm-hmm. Because he knows he is smarter and better and fitter to lead than Gothmog. But Gothmog is strong, right? He's strong and ruthless. Again, that I think is really...
Is Gothmog going to talk with a Brooklyn accent? Hey, use guys.
Yeah. You want I should fix him for you? Yeah, I.
Wear pinstripes. He'll wear pinstripes.
Hey, yeah. As a Red Sox fan, I'm totally into this. But anyway, yeah. Anyway, yeah. So he's competing with Gothmog. He's not willing to submit to Gothmog, but Gothmog demands his submission, right? Gothmog insists that he is the one in charge, and Sauron has to sort of scheme against him. But since Gothmog is completely ruthless, he can see, like, he will only prevail and be able to take charge, and be the one guiding, you know, what happens and everything, if he too is willing to be ruthless. And see, here's the other thing. Here's how I think we can make that lead into the super secret necromantic orc project. Myron is on his own. He doesn't have a posse, right? Gothmog's got a posse. He's got the Balrogs, right? So it's not just Gothmog versus Sauron, it's Gothmog and his gang against Myron. And Myron is kind of on his own, right? Maybe he's able to command some of the, like, monsters, right, that we talked about that Melkor has at that point. But he doesn't have an army. He doesn't have a crew. And, you know, from the beginning, I was thinking about this when I was doing the Lost Road stuff over the last couple weeks. Because in Tolkien's mind, it's very clear that, like, basically, like the orcs and the Balrogs, still, but by 1937, you know, after he'd written The Hobbit and right before he starts The Lord of the Rings, the Silmarillion in the final to that point conception of the Silmarillion, he's still thinking of the Balrogs as a large army. They're still, in Tolkien's mind, thousands of Balrogs. And he even uses, interestingly, he even uses the word cavalry to describe them in the Battle of Sudden Flame. The cavalry of the Balrog. Of the Balrogs came down. Now I don't at all believe that he means them to be, in fact, riding upon horses there. My understanding is that basically it's like, you know, in the armies of Angband, in the wars with the Noldor and the elves of Middle Earth, the orcs are like the infantry and the Balrogs are like the cavalry. They're heavier, faster troops. But they're still troops, right? They're still, like, you know, those are the two divisions of Melkor's army. So this is what's kind of gotten me thinking of, basically, if Sauron is like the leader of the infantry, which, and the orcs individually, of course, are obviously no match for Balrogs, but if there are a lot, so especially if we go in the film version, if we go more towards the published Silmarillion concept of have there being a much smaller number of Balrogs, not having, you know, 1,000 Balrogs, but having maybe a dozen or maybe a couple dozen or something like that, Balrogs. And Sauron then, so if Gothmog shows up at, like, the confrontation between the two of them, and he's got his, like, you know, 20 Balrogs or whatever, and Sauron shows up and he's like, here's me and my 5,000 orcs, like, that then becomes, he can now meet power with power, but he couldn't meet power with power. Without a posse, he can't meet power with power in a conflict with Gothmog.
That makes sense to me.
So this is what leads him. So it's the desire for power, to compete, to assert himself. And he could even say, he could even think that he says, like, he could even have good motivations or believe that he has good motivations, right? The whole orc project could be in, like, he could, Myron could still be telling himself that this is just a means to an end, right? Like Sauron's, or Saruman's speech to Gandalf, right? Deploring many evils done by the way, right? But approving the high and ultimate goal. You know, knowledge, order. Myron could be thinking something kind of like that. But hang on a second. We need a confidant for Myron. He needs somebody to talk to, which is not Gothmog, right? Because he's not going to be, he's not going to, if we're going to have Myron ever uttering aloud any of these things so that the audience can actually tell what's going on within his mind and soul at this point, he's going to need somebody to talk to.
Right.
Thuring Gwethil. Right.
Thuringwethil. Yep.
Because, I mean, he's got two...
I was going to say a skull with glowing eye sockets.
A skull with glowing eye sockets. No. No, no, no. He does not talk to Bob the Skull. Now...
No, I think that's a good idea. I think Thuringwethil is a good idea.
Yeah. So, okay, Chris Graham and Carita both suggest, what about a big, evil, talking cat?
Well, we did talk about Tivildo last time, didn't we?
Tivildo lives, yeah, absolutely.
We did. Last week, they were like, we were like saying that he puts in stupid stuff, and they both turn around and go, shut up, Tivildo.
Right, right. I mean, obviously, the most readily apparent allies that we can give to Myron are those that are with him when we get to the Beren and Lúthien story, right? Mm-hmm. Draugluin, the father of werewolves as well. Is like the other one who's obviously his ally and still with him, and working with him, you know, when he is going to be lieutenant of Morgoth at that island, which was Minas Tirith, you know, at Tol Angharhoth. So we've got Draugluin, we've got Thuringwethil, and it would be great to introduce. So if Thuringwethil, that, if Thuringwethil is the spy at Quivienen, which, as I said last time, I really, really, really like, and she goes back and she reports to Myron, we can have him beginning to scheme. He can just be talking with Thuringwethil and basically trying to sort out, you know, what do we do? How do we handle this? What kind of advantage could this give us against, you know, Gothmog in this power struggle. Definitely Thuringwethil and Draugluin, possibly Tivildo. See, it's hard because, like, I can't, it's very difficult for me not to laugh at Tivildo, because Tivildo is comical. I mean, I think it's one of the great things that Tolkien took it out, because, like, Tivildo is... I find Tivildo funny in the Book of Lost Tales, even though he's, you know, even when he's not really intended to be comical, I find him kind of funny. I'm not sure if that's a good or a bad thing.
We should probably use him sparingly.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, he could be done. Like, we don't have to use him comically. Like, having a big evil cat is, like, that could be done in a non-comical way if we wanted to and tried really
hard.
I think
so.
We could even have him, as Chris Graham was suggesting, we could have him basically serving, you know, again, in seriousness and not in comedy, as a kind of foil for Huon, which is indeed his role in the original Lost Tale, and he could even be killed by Huon.
Something along the line of Thundercats.
Oh God!
Not exactly like
I'm
that.
I'm sorry. I'm the unwelcome comic relief today. I apologize.
You're gonna turn Tavildo into Snarf.
Yeah, Snarf. That's what I was thinking. Snarf. Yeah.
Okay. Well, here's another problem, though.
That won't be comical at all.
No, at all.
I know.
No, really zero comical potential. We can't have too many. Drug Lewin is already going to get killed by Huon, right? So we can't have Huon just killing all or half of, you know, Myron's counselors there.
Right.
And presumably Thorin Gwethil buys it too, but that's not even, that happens off stage even everywhere, right? I mean, we never really see that. So we totally need to imagine Rickle Richards says, just Googled big evil cat. The results were not promising. I agree. Well, I don't know. Okay. I'm still willing to hold off on the Tavildo question. But
well, I mean, it could be a tiger. I mean, it could be a big game cat, right?
Well, yeah.
I mean,
I'm thinking like panther, basically. You know.
Yeah, and will it be a talking cat? Will it be a talking cat?
Well, will Doug Lewin like, be a talking wolf? Will Huon be a talking dog?
That's true. In the Jungle Book, right? The most recent Jungle Book, we had Bagheera, right?
Right.
Was
right.
Talking leopard.
And Shere Khan, right? So it would
Shere
be like
Khan,
in, like
right.
an evil combination.
Yeah.
I'm not thinking of what's his name from the Butcher Books.
Oh yeah, what? What, Bob?
Oh no,
not Bob. You mean Mister the cat?
Oh
yeah, of course. I have to admit that I am affected by thinking of Cat Sith to some extent. But
yeah. But actually, now I kind of like the idea of it being Bob, just like sort of an overly large house cat that Myron
Mister
talks
cat,
to.
Yeah, Mister the cat. Yeah.
Yeah.
Mister, like Mister. Yeah.
Yeah. That he just talks to and then, you know, assumes that Tavildo is thinking and responding.
Right. Of course, we could just have Tavildo be like the cat that he strokes Bond villain fashion, you know, and that's right.
And talks to yeah. as a crazy person.
Yeah. When he starts pampering his cat is when we know that he's crossed the line, you know, and has become totally evil.
That's right.
Yeah. sorry. I apologize to cat people for that previous remark. But all I can say is Tolkien would totally agree. But anyway, well, we don't need to resolve that today. So, having thought about this, though, this is another little sort of project I would like to invite people who are interested in this, because this is a sub theme that we're going to need to keep going all the way through. And I think where we want to end it. Yeah, sorry, Dave, go ahead.
I was just saying so the project is to brainstorm Myron's crew.
Yes, Myron's crew, and just the whole sort of the progress of the story arc. Because it's not like we're going to do a whole episode on this, right? You know, at no point are we going to just interrupt the story and be like, meanwhile, here's what the bad guys were up to. This is something that we're going to need to integrate and give glimpses of throughout the story. So the two questions here would be how, you know, what moments in this do we want to touch on, and how and where do we want to work them in over the course of the overall story. My primary thought is where this arc should end. And I think that where this arc should end should definitely be
with the beginning of the Necromantic Orc Project. Like, Sauron begins to make the orcs is where that is definitely where this could go, such that, because we're not going to need the orcs until next season. Season 3 is the first time the orcs are going to actually come out and start attacking folks, when we're going to get the initial battles between the orcs and the Sindar and the Nandor in Beleriand. And we're going to get that next time during Season 3. So, but we want to set that up, right? We want to have, like, this is both the sort of the turning point and maybe the point when Sauron's name changes, right? When he becomes the Accursed, when he becomes Sauron. He ceases to be Myron and becomes Sauron. Though we're changing Melkor's name at the end of this season, too, so that might be too soon. But
would a concurrent name change be Outer Line?
Yeah, I don't know. I have to keep thinking about that. But anyway, so basically the ultimate arc is is, you know, the Myron to Sauron arc. But of course, we also want to make sure that we are reviewing, like, the imminent threat of the orcs there in Middle-earth. So we need to be building that. But again, all these things, Sauron and his counselors, Gothmog and his, you know, bully boy thug tactics trying to take over, Myron's desire to not let him take over, and his possibly his reasons for that, which at least masquerade as noble reasons, and his decision to be ruthless and his undertaking of the Orc Project, all these things we need to be giving glimpses and reminding the viewers, that these things are happening. So we got to figure out what scenes we want to give from this and how we want to spread this out among the rest. I think starting with the Thorin Gwethil reporting to Myron at the end, either at the end of the last episode or the beginning of this one, would work well. How do we want to go on from there, and how do we want to integrate it? Those are questions that we should also be thinking about as we move forward. Okay, so I've even given you questions for next time, and I've already assigned you two major projects, right, to the listeners. Be thinking about that, like, list of things we want to do in the frame, and start thinking about how we might want to shape that, and then list of things we want to show in the progress of the bad guys, you know, and particularly Myron's arc, and think about how we might want to shape that and integrate that or parallel that with the Valinor story as well. Mm-hmm. Okay, good. So now, hey, I've got an idea. Let's talk about episode 3. Or 4. I mean 4. That's what we're doing today. Let's talk about episode 4. So, okay. One thing I want to sort of start off by kind of clarifying, because I think it really, to me, really relates quickly back to the episode 4 question. Because the first question is about the Nandor, right? Chronologically, the first event that we're going to get here is the decision of Lenwë to abandon the march. And as several people very rightly pointed out on the discussion boards, the published Silmarillion attributes it essentially to fear. Like, they get to the Misty Mountains and they're like, nah, no, we're good. We don't really want to cross the Misty Mountains. We'll just stay here, thanks. And if we just make them be like, oh, mountains, are you kidding me? Oh, I'm so tired already. Never mind. Or if we make them like, what? Oh, mountains. I am wholly terrified at the sight of the mountains, and I'm going to cower here in fear under the eaves of this forest. Neither one of those stories strikes me as a particularly good story, or a particularly sort of admirable foundation for the cultures of the people of Mirkwood and Lothlorien, which is what we're kind of doing here, looking forward. So that's kind of not enough for me. But the logical follow-up question, which was under discussion on the discussion board, is basically, do we depict Lenwë as merely, you know, Lenwë and his people as as essentially defecting back to the Avari. So, you know, a bunch of the Teleri said, no, we're not going, we're unwilling, we're going to stay at Qui Vienen. And a bunch of them went, but quickly had second thoughts. Like, basically, is Lanwë merely having a second thought on the decision to leave Qui Vienen in the first place? Right? And he's like, actually, you know, okay, we've come a little ways, but, you know, now that I've had some more time to think it over, I think I want to stay anyway, actually, so forget about it. So is Lenwe's decision essentially just a recapitulation of the decision that the Avari made? Here are my thoughts about this. I think we want to think carefully about the fundamental terms, the fundamental choice that's being made. And this kind of goes back to our discussion last time. As I was thinking it, it kind of came a little bit clearer to me. Ultimately, the two issues, right, the two major premises of the debate in episode three were fear and desire, right? And there's an argument from fear and an argument from desire on both sides, right? The side of the Avari, they're saying, we are afraid of the Valar, and we don't entirely trust them, and we don't know what will happen to us if we go over there, and we desire Middle-earth, and we like it here and want to stay here. So they have an argument from fear and an argument from desire. The ones who go, the Eldar argument, works very similarly, right? There is an argument from fear. Middle-earth is dangerous and we're not safe here. Let's go to Valinor where it's nice and safe. And an argument from desire. The West is awesome. The Valar are awesome. And from what we hear of Valinor, that place rules. So let's go there. So there are a couple different things that I think that we can do with this to kind of, as we move forward. I would say anyone who makes a decision based on either one of the arguments from fear, like, that's a bad choice. Anyone who is convinced by either of the fear arguments that means I think there's like a subset of people on both sides who are basically doing that. Some of the people who are leaving because they're fearful. They're like, oh man, we've been living here in fear, like the Dark Rider, and then there was this battle and everything. You know, then they're like, it looked like the world was coming to an end, and so we could go live with the gods and be safe. Count me in, man. Like this is a bad neighborhood here, right? I want to go where it's safe. That's a bad reason to go to Valinor, and I would think that people who go to Valinor for that reason are like on pretty shaky ground.
Mm-hmm.
Similarly, the people who just reject the Valar out of fear are also unruly shit. And that can be, that's not Eol's entire story, but I mean, distrust of the Valar, which is, you know, distrust in this sense being kind of a subspecies of the fear argument, essentially, can be Eol's primary argument. But the arguments from desire on both sides are much stronger. And that's where I think we can see. I mean, again, as I was saying last time, we want to make sure that, like, the arguments on both, there are good arguments and bad arguments on both sides. And there are good reasons and bad reasons both to leave and to stay. It's not just a black and white going is good and staying is bad kind of thing. And so here's sort of what I'm thinking then. On the one hand, Lenwë decides to stay because of desire. In other words, there is much in common between his desire to stay in, like, the general Mirkwood Lothlorien region, because he loves the place. You know, because of desire. But I think there should be something else, because my thought is that in this episode, the primary primary theme behind the arguments in the debate on both sides are fear and desire. But we get we can get a glimpse of a third thing besides fear and desire. A third thing, which is really kind of a higher thing than both of those, and that is purpose or calling. Right, this sense of, like, no, we have a, like, it is right for us to do this. Not I want to do this or I don't want to do that, but it is the thing that we should be doing. That's what I think we can introduce with Lenwë, actually. He doesn't just stay because he likes it. He does like it in that area, and that obviously informs him, and he doesn't just give up on Valinor, and he doesn't just say, you know, but you know, so it's neither fear nor desire, but he has a purpose. He has a, he finds something there. And this, I think, is as a couple people were recalling I had said and were talking about in the discussion boards, this is where I think we bring in the Ents. The story of the elves awakening the trees and teaching them to talk, I think we need to do that. We need to, I think we need to introduce the Ents and,
yeah.
And the origin of the Ents. And I think that this is where we do it. Here's what I mean when I talk about... when I talk about the purpose for Lenway, or this like sense of purpose or calling, because again, this has direct bearing back to Arwen, right? Like, are we supposed to fulfill a purpose here on Middle Earth? That's always one of the questions. And when Tolkien says that, you know, basically the Valar were wrong to invite, you know, to bring them out of Middle Earth and bring them over to Valinor. Part of the implication really does seem to be the elves were supposed to be in Middle-earth. They had a job to do there. You know, Iluvatar put them there for a reason.
Mm-hmm.
What was that reason? Well, generally, like, they were, they have something to contribute to the shaping of Middle-earth, right? They have something, like, the Middle-earth was designed to be like, and you think about the role that they do have, right? We get later on the story of the Ents and the waking up of the Ents, but even after that, in the chronology of Middle-earth, before that, in the chronology of Tolkien's writing of the Middle-earth material, you have the teaching of the men, like, the humans survive in large part because they meet elves. They meet Avari, who are there, and the Avari teach them. They teach them language, and they, you know, they help them to survive. And you know, we can you can read it, especially again in the stuff I'm doing right. My head is full of the stuff I'm doing in the Lost Road right now. But you can read some of that stuff in the Lost Road to suggest like the men would have been toast if not for the Avari. Like they really saved them. And help them to survive. And that's something I think we could actually do when we get there, to really show the role that the Avari play there, and that they're playing a really productive role. This is what I'm thinking. So I'm thinking it's the encounter, like Lenway and Treebeard, basically. He encounters the Ents. They teach them. He enters into like a partnership with them. Well, you know, not a business partnership, obviously, but like basically, Lenway sees like, hey, like we have a job here, right? Like, he meets the Ents. He teaches them how to speak. He talks with Treebeard, and their conversation goes on so long that the rest of the Teleri just leave. No, I'm just kidding about that. He talks to Treebeard and teaches Treebeard how to speak, and. They basically this helps Lenway to recognize like we elves have a job to do here. Like there is something that, you know, because Treebeard is attached. The, you know, Treebeard talks about when as soon as Treebeard does learn to speak, his own job, his own duty is clear. Right. Nobody cares for the forests like I do anymore. Right. Well, but maybe Lenway did. Right. Or maybe Lenway embraces that. Here's Lenway being on Treebeard's side, like nobody is on the side of the trees anymore, right? But he recognizes, like, we have a calling to this. This is what we're supposed to do. So, does he love Middle-earth and want to stay? Yeah. Does he really like it in Lothlorien and Mirkwood? Yeah, but that's not his reason, right? That's not enough reason. He doesn't just get bored and decide to stay behind. He stays behind for a reason, for a purpose, capital P. And we don't even necessarily need to see or show what exactly that purpose is, right? Mm-hmm. But he sees that he has a purpose. And the rest of the Teleri who go on, I mean, I think it could be really interesting to sort of show they don't even really know their purpose yet. So, like, they're continuing to Valinor, and the Nandor are staying behind. But it can even kind of look that it's, like, it's the Nandor that are... Far from the Nandor being, like, the feckless ones who just get bored soonest on the trip. You know, we don't want to depict the Nandor as being, like, are we there yet? Are we there yet? Never mind. Instead, they're the ones who have a goal, who have a clearer goal.
Even the, you know, so because the goal of Valinor is still kind of vague. Like they're just going to the good place, but they don't really have a purpose for doing it, other than desire, which is a good thing in itself, but it's not really enough on its own. And that kind of discovery of purpose is something that is going to sort of trickle down, right? Elwë is going to discover his purpose with Melian. Círdan is going to discover his purpose, right, in staying by the sea. Olwë can also discover his purpose in going to Valinor. Now we have to, you know, some of those are not really clear to me yet. Always in particular is least clear. I think of those, Círdan is most. Elwë is kind of middle ground in my mind. But I think that, again, that shift from mere desire to the purpose, and ultimately, in a sense, the purpose which was at the root of the desire all along, the purpose which is itself the ultimate fulfillment of the desire, or the purpose for which the desire was itself merely a preparation or a guide, or to which it was a guide, is, I think, a really interesting sort of sub-theme of season two, ultimately, especially in this first half, with the divisions among the Teleri. So that's my suggestion about Lenway and his motivations. What do you guys think about that?
Well, this does this jives with our discussion last time about trying to sort of have, you know, a spectrum of you know, kind of like the different motivations and stuff, and having some of them be more noble and some of them be less so.
I approve. I am Trish Lambert, and I approve this message. I have a side question, which I don't think I ever knew this, or if I did, I've forgotten it. Whatever happened, do we know what happens to Lenway? I mean, theoretically, he could still be alive at the time that the Lord of the Rings takes place.
No, we don't. You know, we get Denethor, right? Who is
right? I know we got Denethor. Yeah, who
branches off and comes across. Though that's a late change. Again, Lost Road. By the time we get to 1937, by the end of the first phase of this, of the, you know, the first major phase of the Silmarillion development, from the Book of Lost Tales through the Silmarillion Tolkien was trying to get published in 1937, Denethor and the Green Elves of Osiriand are Noldor, actually. They're a Noldor branch that branches off and wanders around Middle-earth and then eventually comes into Beleriand. He changes that to, and his motivation for that appears to be 100% linguistic, like philological, because it creates a more interesting philological situation in Beleriand, right? Where you have like a group of people whose language was originally Noldoran, but then it changes over time because they're separated from the rest of the Noldor. So you've got the distinction between their language and the other Noldor's language who go to Valinor. But wait, there's more. Then they come into close geographical contact with Teleran elves, right? Especially the Sindar of Doriath. And so their language, which was originally Noldoran, but then changes, gets heavily influenced by the Sindarin language from Doriath, and so their language then gets moved in a totally different direction by like that combination of separation and influence. This is how Tolkien is thinking and what is driving the story. He's going to change it eventually to say that they're an offshoot of the Teleri, and I think we should just stick with that. We're going to need a reason for Denethor to come into Beleriand and to break off from Lenwë. Though he's not going to be broken off entirely. Remember, the Ents are going to come in on the side of the Green Elves, along with Beren at the battle later on. And I'm kind of thinking, I don't know about you, but I'm kind of thinking I want Ents to be involved sooner. I want more Ent involvement in the
Me
first
too.
Age, yeah. For crying out loud. At the least, more Ent sightings. I mean, Treebeard talks about being all the heck over Beleriand, right? He's in Dorthonion.
Yeah, they should be more frequent. Yeah, almost common to some extent.
Yeah,
you know?
The Willow Meads of Tessarinen. Treebeard has been everywhere in Beleriand, obviously,
right.
Based on his song. So, we totally need to have him cropping up. I mean, I think having some Ents destroyed in the Battle of Sudden Flame, right, would be really cool. To have many of them perish with the pine woods of Dorthonion.
And we probably should show them herding Huorns, too.
Yes, yes. Ooh, Robert, excellent suggestion. Robert Brown says Tuor could meet Treebeard down in the Willowmeads. Yeah, I like that. I like that, Robert. I think Tuor, in his wanderings, should totally meet Treebeard. That's a thing that should totally happen.
That's a great idea.
Anyway... So yeah, but as far as what happens with Lenway, yeah, I don't know if we want to invent a tragic death for him, you know, at some later point. For now, we don't need to worry about it because he's never going to come into Beleriand, and the rest of the time we're going to be in, you know, starting in episode 5, we're going to be in Beleriand for the rest of time. I mean, we're crossing the Misty Mountains in this episode, so, you know, we won't be back. The Corita says, vis-a-vis the death of many Ents in the Battle of Sudden Flames, if by cool I mean totally heartbreaking, then yes, she agrees. Corita, that's exactly what I mean. Just imagine the added pathos, right? Because again, it's one of the functions of Ents, right? One of the functions of Ents is to show that. The destruction, the ruin of Beleriand itself over the course of the wars with Morgoth is part of, like, it's not just the death of the people that is the tragedy, that is a tragedy, but the ruin of Beleriand itself, the destruction of the land and its beauty is a major feature in the story. And one of the things that the Ents do is to, like, invite you to look at, like, don't take for granted, like, the destruction of forests. It's a big deal. Right. And the Ents help us to, like, emotionally understand that it's a big deal. So that's exactly, Corita, what I think that we can do. Like, we should be weeping not just for, like, Angrod and Egnor, who are going to die in the Battle of Sudden Flame, and for, like, Barahir and all of his people who are mostly going to get wiped out, and ultimately just leaving Barahir and Beren and the outlaw band. We'll have plenty of people to mourn over, especially, by the way, remember, Ignor is going to get, I called him Ignor because that's what he's still called in The Lost Road. Ignor is going to get a love interest. He's Andreth's boyfriend, and he's going to die a tragic death.
That's right.
And she's going to be bereft. So there's going to be lots of...
Listen how excited he is when he says that. He's going to die a tragic death.
Oh,
and
man.
He's going to be bereft.
You're positively giddy over this.
The pathos, man, absolutely. So lots of pathos, but again, the pathos isn't just the people, right? So we're going to have lots of pathos with the death of Angrod and Ignor, and we're going to have lots of pathos with the death of like the people of Beor, basically. But we want people not only to be, you know, weeping for the elves who have died and weeping for the men who have died, but weeping for the ruin of Dorthonion itself. Dorthonion is going to, you know, the pine forests of Dorthonion are going to be destroyed. And what's more, then twisted and warped and become Tower Nufuin, right? They're going to become Mirkwood. They're going to become this, you know, evil, twisted forest that even orcs fear to go into. That itself is a tragedy, right? That itself, like, we should be weeping for Dorthonion, if not quite as much, still significantly. I think that's Ents definitely can be instrumental in that. Ooh, that's interesting. Tony Mead suggests that Lenway should die in the Second Age in the wars between Sauron and the Elves. Maybe we could bring him back in at that point. That is interesting. That is interesting. Yeah. Anyway. Okay. All right. So there's Lenway sorted.
But the rest of them decide to go on. Elway and the others decide to go on. Right, they're still going to Valinor. Elway is still leading them. He's the ambassador, right? He's still coming back from Valinor and urging them on to Valinor. So he'll respect Lenway's decision, right? It will not be an acrimonious parting, I would not think, between Lenway and Elway. I guess we could go that way. We could make Elway. It would make Elway's own sort of conversion experience with Melian the more striking, but I don't think we need to go that far, you know, to have him. I mean, that's a little bit
overdone,
I think. Anyway, so like Elway and Lenway part as friends, and Elway leads the rest of the people, and they cross the Misty Mountains. So then the next thing we need is Elway's discovery of Melian. Okay. The fact that we have Elway, the reason given in the published Silmarillion is a perfectly fine one to maintain, that he's going to hang out with Finwë. The Noldor have gotten quite a bit ahead, and so he's journeying up to talk to Finwë, and he's returning back to his people when he meets Melian. So having him journey alone to go see Finwë, like, that's fine. And Elway is like the adventurous wanderer anyhow. So nobody would necessarily think it's strange that Elway decides to go off on his own to go see Finwë. And he leaves his brother Olwë in charge. This, I think, is important, right? When he leaves to go see Finwë, the last thing that he tells Olwë is, you know, make sure you keep the people moving, right? You know, continue on towards Valinor. And I will catch up with you eventually. Which, of course, is true. After his death, but whatever. Like, he will catch up with him eventually in Valinor.
Also, you take the really long view.
Long, yeah. Which, you know, elves, right? So they would. Anyway, so he heads off. What do you guys think about the meeting with Melian? Any thoughts on how to handle that? Yeah.
You don't think we can just portray it as described in the book?
I can't remember who said this, but somehow that we see Melian's ability to do sort of what will become the Girdle of Melian, hiding thing, you know, because it's like although we've already separated him from his group, right?
Yes.
But the thing is, the ability to do the girdle is they could very well be searching for him, you know, right where he is, but they can't see him because she's done that. I mean, I like that.
Agreed. We do need a good reason to have them not find him, right? Yes. Now, okay. Here's one of the things, which is another of the things that has really kind of come much clearer in my mind since doing the History of Middle-earth series in the Mythgard Academy than it was when back in my old days when I had only read the published Silmarillion. I never really understood the Girdle of Melian. Like, what is it exactly? What is, like, if you were to go to attempt to cross the Girdle, to enter Doriath uninvited, what exactly would you experience? I mean, I think when I was originally reading it, when I was young, I pictured just a kind of like force field or like impenetrable barrier, right? Mm-hmm. I had very vague ideas about this. But going back and trying to examine my really vague ideas, that's, I think, what I kind of had in my mind. But that's not it. When you go back Tolkien is much clearer about how the Girdle of Melian functions when you read when you read the alliterative lay of the Children of Húrin, and you get the story of Túrin going to Doriath, because he and his guides get lost. They don't, you know, that it's they can't make it through the Girdle, and it's only because Beleg finds them and has mercy on them that he brings them through the Girdle, the experience that Tolkien describes, it's fear. People are terrified. It's like fear and horror overcomes you and you can't go through.
this is why, this explains a thing that I never really fully understood in the published Silmarillion about Nen Dungortheb, that really dangerous strip of land north of Doriath and south of Dorthonion, right, where Shelob's brood all live and where Beren has a really bad time, right? There's this like region of madness between, because you've got two big major sorceries, right? You've got the power of Melian and her girdle bordering the evil of the forest of Tower Nafuin. And both of them are kind of similar, actually. Uh-huh. Both of them are like terrifying and disorienting, right? Mm-hmm. And so the description, even in the published Silmarillion, of that place where the two of them meet, and there's this like destructive interference at the boundary between the girdle of Melian and like the horror of Tower Nafuin. And that's why everything goes completely bananas in that region. And it's a land of like insanity because of this like destructive interference. But it's not destructive interference as between light and dark. They're similar. I mean, the effects are similar. You've got terror on the north and terror on the south. Now, terror primarily for the enemies of Doriath, right? It's the bad guys who experience terror, but of course the bad guys, like the orcs, experience terror in Tower Nafuin as well. So, Robert Brown says, it's more like constructive interference. Yes, exactly. Exactly. Because they are similar. They're in conflict, but they are similar. And the more I thought about that, because so Trish, I was thinking about this in connection with what you were just pointing out that people were discussing about, like, basically Thingol coming into a like little mini, you know,
girdle
field, right?
Girdle field
around Nan Elmoth, where they have this mirror. And here's why I like this, because like, it picks up on the theme, right? What do you have? Fear and desire, right? Fear and desire. You've got fear, right? And his overcoming his fear to find, because he wants to find what's there, right? And when he gets past the fear, you know, when he pushes past his fear and he gets, what does he find? Desire, right? He finds his own heart's desire and he finds satisfaction. So on the one hand, I really like how those sort of sub themes really kind of work in, and through that,
yeah,
what
that
does
even works. That works really well with the bad guys too, by the way. Fear and desire, Myron's story.
Yes,
you know,
that's true. You know?
Right.
Yes, fear and desire, but sort of twisted into like his desire, but his desire sort of twisted, and yeah.
Right.
Now Brian asks, why is Melian putting fear in this place? Why is she doing the mini girdle thing? She sort of chosen Nan Elmoth as a kind of a laboratory space to try this out, right? Is she, I don't know.
A little R&D.
Yeah, exactly. Right. She's on retreat, right? She's like, I got this concept, but I need to experiment. So I'm choosing this, this little forest as a pilot program.
Is Melian a Yavanna, Maya? Is she a Yavanna person? Or do we know? Does it ever say? I mean, because I was just thinking, because Yavanna, that would totally be something Yavanna would do, is like, she would even say, Melian, go test this out. We need to go, you know. I'm sending you to Middle-earth on a mission to research this thing.
Why am I blanking on this? She sings in Lorien, but she's not one of the people of Lorien. She is. Oh, shoot! Is it Yavanna?
Is it ever specified, or does it?
Yes,
does he not?
It is, and oh, it does. I am okay. Completely blanking. Yeah, see, Robert, exactly. That's Robert Brown has anticipated where I was going with this. Nan Elmoth, you'll remember, is the place where Aeol ends up.
And
as Robert Brown is reminding us,
right,
he's going to do to Aradhel, like with Aeol and Aradhel, we're going to get like a twisted version of what happens with Thingol and Melian.
That's right.
Right?
That's right.
She comes through this forest of fear and ends up finding her spouse on the inside, but it's a much darker, twisted version of, and she ends up being really imprisoned.
You know, that makes their son, kind of blanking on his name, sort of the dark side of Luthien.
Yeah.
Kind of in a parallel, interestingly enough.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Okay. Brian and Robert are both reminding us that she served Vanna and Este. I'm not sure.
Okay.
That's not true in the earlier version. Sorry, again, like I've got my head full of The Lost Road. And if I'm remembering correctly and now I'm like totally going to have to look it up. Which fortunately I have The Lost Road at my elbow at all times. I want to say that she is, I'm sure it's not Vanna and Este at that point in the development. Great. There are like a billion references to Melian in this book. Well, that's not helpful. Okay. I've forgotten that. She has another name? Of course she does. Okay. Anyway, sorry. Toril, by the way, is apparently her other name. I've forgotten that. All right. Oh yeah. Where's that whole the version of the story that we get in the Hlamas? Yeah. Oh well. I'm not going to be able to find it. I'm not going to be able to find it on demand. I'm horrible at that. All right. Never mind.
It was a valiant effort.
It was a valiant effort. Yeah, I know it's Vanna and Este in the published Silmarillion. I think it's Yavanna. If I'm remembering correctly, in The Lost Road, she's of the people of Yavanna. She hangs out in Lorien, but she's not of the people of Lorien. But that's okay, right? I mean, I'm actually okay depicting the Maiar as like slightly more sort of free agents. Brian Fattorini is teasing me. We're now into Professor Olson mutters provocatively about obscure Tolkien stories.
I know. I was thinking about how fun that's going to be for people listening to the podcast.
Yeah,
that's all good. Audio.
It's all good. Yes. Yeah. Okay. Well, anyway, all right, it's fine. So she's definitely in Lorien, but the fact that she's we can have her be of the people of Lorien, but the fact that she's of the people of Lorien still itself wouldn't even stop her from coming at behest of Yavanna. Like, she and Yavanna could be hanging out in Lorien. Do we want to do that, by the way? Do we want to just meet Melian out of nowhere? Do we want to do a previous scene with Melian in Valinor, and like why on earth Melian is there? And what her
point is?
We've
mentioned before that we wanted her to be present, even in the first season.
Yes.
Not necessarily named or something, but...
And see, this is kind of... So, that reminds me. So, see, one of the cool things here... again, fear and desire, and following up on the themes from last time, right? So, when Elway vanishes and doesn't come back, everybody thinks he's been nabbed, right? Everyone's like,
right.
Oh, great, you know, there goes another one. And so they're afraid, still, more... again, right? And they track him,
And they can track him to, like, Nanelmoth. They can track him to the place right. where he vanished, and it's a place of fear. And so they're like, oh, man, this place is so... Boy, we can't even go in here, right? Because she sort of sets her girdle around it, certainly post Thingol arriving, and probably before. So they're going to be convinced, like, he's been nabbed, and whatever is in that forest is evil, obviously, right? Because it, like, ate Elway and is, like, you know, is terrifying to approach. So they're going to be all convinced. And I was thinking, like, well, you know, we have to be careful lest we convince a bunch of our viewers that she really is evil. How are we going to telegraph this to our viewers? Because the Teleri themselves can be in doubt. You know, and when he emerges and is like, hi, I'm fine, and here's my new wife, right? I mean, some of his followers can be like, didn't your mother ever tell you about, like, meeting strange women in forests and, like, you can't always trust this kind of thing? And, you know, are you sure she's totally above board and not, like, you know, some kind of evil seductress or something, right? I mean, like, that's got to be on the table, especially if they have the experience in Nanelmoth, right? Oh, interesting. Tony Mead says they can talk about her the way the Rohirrim talk about Galadriel. That's actually a really interesting parallel.
Mm, yeah. Interesting.
Yeah.
That's a good suggestion.
Yeah, that is. That is. But again, we want to be careful lest our viewers suspect Melian from here on, right? I mean, we do want to convey, true. Right, that no, she's not a bad guy, right? But how do we do that exactly? I mean, how do we both introduce doubts and questions, which would be very natural to be held in the minds of the elves, you know, the Sindar, who are looking for him and worrying about him and mourning for him, frankly. And, you know, and with the parallel that we've established with the Dark Rider, right? But she turns out to be good. How do we do that? Karita was saying, she's wondering if the mini girdle thing is just kind of a natural thing that happens around Melian. Then the big girdle is her putting forth her power, you know, putting forth power to extend that natural quality. And she says that the words big girdle amuse me to no end. Frankly, it's Karita, it's really impossible to, Tolkien was obviously much more mature, certainly than I, as like, I can't help but, sort of titter in an adolescent fashion about the girdle of Melian. you know, it's, I'm sorry, like, but you know, one has to acknowledge these things. It's part of the healing process. So, yeah, Mariel, like an aura of holy fear. Yeah, kind of like that. I mean, yes. And something that is, but see, here's the thing. It's not only a terror which absolutely repels the servants of Morgoth, but even potential allies. I mean, there are exactly two people on record who ever just make it through. Howsoever pure in heart they may be, the only two people would be Thingol, if we do it this way, and Beren, right? And again, I like that parallel, like the two of them are fated, right? It is their fate that draws them in. That's why none of his followers and kin can get to him and find out where he is, because it is not their fate to be able to sort of go through there. Right, three, Karkaroth, true. Robert, yes, you're right. Karkaroth with the power of the Silmaril that is in him. I stand corrected. I'm so lucky to have Robert Brown here to keep me honest about these things. very good. Very good. Yeah. Tony says it can be cued by the song of the nightingales. See, that's a really interesting thing, though, right? I mean, she teaches the nightingales their song, and there are nightingales singing around her. Do we want to make the Song of Nightingales creepy? I don't think we do, because we want them associated with Luthien, right? That has to be a good thing. The Song of the Nightingales.
So you're wondering, yeah, there's a dilemma, right? Like, how do we plant the sort of some amount of suspicion that doesn't hang around?
Yes, yes. Robert Brown is suggesting it's how she's shown to be good by the bird's friendship. And yeah, it will enable us to depict a scene which seems obviously peaceful. Again, there's always the suspicion that, like, it's too peaceful, right? That it's just a put on, and she's really, like, Ungoliant in disguise or something. I mean, remember, we've got a parallel here. Remember Ungoliant and Nessa back in season one, right?
Mm-hmm.
So we have actually a parallel for, like, you know, femme fatale that you meet out in the fields, right? And who like draws you in and then ensnares you and tries to eat you. So, you know, we have that.
But this might be another reason why we need to have her introduced early, you know, in Valinor.
No,
her in Valinor.
Yeah, we definitely should see her in Valinor. And that by itself should be a good cue for attentive readers.
I mean, and not just once, but as part of, like,
yes,
she's there, you know, when stuff happens and she cries when the trees are destroyed. You know what I mean? It's like, all that stuff.
Right, right. Yes, now Tony Mead points out that, remember, Baron doesn't know who Luthien is or whether she's an evil siren when he meets her for the first time. And yes, like the whole, like the way that he is ensnared and, you know, drawn in, it's exactly in the tradition of fairy stories of the mortal man wandering in the woods and seeing the elf maiden from a distance, and often those stories really don't end well. I mean, the moment when Luthien, the elf maiden, turns and sets her hand in Baron's is the moment where Tolkien is, like, deliberately doing something which is a departure from the standard. Like, it looks like the standard fairy tale plot to that point. And that's where the dramatic shift comes. Okay. So, two options then. Option number one. Melian is in Valinor, and she's like, I want to go to Middle-earth for some reason. And when she's in Middle-earth, the girdle thing is just a thing that happens. Like, she automatic. It's part of who she is. She projects this,
sort of,
like,
follows her around everywhere she goes.
Yeah, she's in this, like, this little girdle bubble.
Is she creating girdles in Valinor as well?
Presumably not, right? That would be clearly the downside of this, right? Is this either this is something just native to Melian, and she's wandering in Middle-earth,
like,
and so it happens to be
kind of like
her.
Peanuts in, yeah, it's kind of like what's his name in Peanut, Pigpen in Peanuts, right?
Just like Pigpen in Peanuts. Yes. Now there's two fictional characters I'd never connected in my mind before. but okay. Then the second thing. Tony says it's like an emotional version of the Unlight of Ungoliant. Okay, so this option two is she decides to go. She decides to go to Middle Earth for a particular reason, and she is a staff. And I certainly incline to the second one because, again, purpose, right? Like, she sees that she has a purpose. Maybe she doesn't understand fully what it is yet. Like, she might not actually foresee Thingol personally, right? But she knows, you know, she has a desire to go to Middle-earth, and, like, it's part of her purpose, right? She needs to establish, to go to Middle-earth and to protect it, or at least a part of it, is her purpose. That's her job. And she doesn't know where it's supposed to be or how it's supposed to be. So this gets us back to the pilot project in Nan Helmoth, right? So she's there practicing, right? She's practicing the whole girdle creation process, right? And Thingol stumbles into it. And when he, driven by his fate, comes through the girdle, her first response is not, well, I guess I better change the recipe because this sucker's obviously not working, right? I got, you know, every lost elf wandering through the woods just waltzes right through this sucker. I gotta increase the power, clearly. But no, that's not her conclusion. Instead, she recognizes that, like, this is her fate. To join with Thingol, and that, you know, that that the two of them together are supposed to form a realm. Yeah, Chris, I think that's exactly what I kind of had in the back of my mind there. Chris Graham says maybe she was planning on being a sort of Tom Bombadil, but then meeting Thingol changes everything and draws her into the history of elves. In fact, Chris, let's go one more than that. She can meet Tom Bombadil, right? And they'll be like, hey, yeah, this is great. Let's each of us claim a little part. Claim a little part of Middle Earth, and we'll protect it, and we'll be the and they go, and but then, you know, he goes one way and she goes another, because we haven't done the Tom Bombadil cameo yet. It's got to happen.
Should they have this conversation in Valinor? You know, where Tom's a Maia, maybe in a different form, and then, you know, he comes to Middle Earth and takes on the yellow boots. And
I don't think Tom Bombadil's ever been to Valinor.
You don't think so? Okay.
No, I think he's been right there in Middle Earth. He's got to stake his claim earlier than that.
Oh, okay. So he split off way sooner.
Way sooner.
Maybe after Elmarin, after the lamps or something.
He never left. Yeah. So yeah. If we show Tom Bombadil setting up, like, Tom Bombadil, like, laying the foundations of his little cottage, right? That's got to be, like, during the Almarin period before the destruction of the lamps.
Yeah.
Clearly. Yeah. Robert, exactly. They are genii locus, or genii loci of Earth. Yeah, I think and presumably there are more of them, right? There are. Some,
I was just going to say that doesn't mean there can't be more of them.
There are some of the spirits of Valinor.
Hey, the white stag in Mirkwood, right? Hey, you know.
Yeah, there are lots of possibilities of places where, you know, that have sort of strong spirit. I mean, like Karathras, for instance.
Uh huh.
Right.
That's true. Right.
So.
That's a great way to explain Karathras, actually.
Yeah, I just thought of that. But it is a really good way to explain
it
Karathras.
Is a good way,
it never occurred
it?
To me before. Yeah. So maybe we introduce this as a thing, right?
That's what I'm thinking.
In Valinor, like, of that many of the Maiar over there, many of the spirits are basically wanting to come and to go to Middle Earth and. And so Melian is sort of the poster child of the Tom Bombadil has already been there, but again, I insist on the Tom Bombadil cameo in every season. Like, that's got to happen. Every single season we need Tom Bombadil at least once, right?
Wouldn't Goldberry's mother qualify
for
that? Yeah,
Goldberry's mother would qualify. Absolutely.
Yeah. Interesting. I like that.
So she decides she's going to go to Middle Earth, and she's going to. And so she's setting up. So maybe Nan Elmoth is where she decides. Tony Mead says each time he should be called by a different name. Yeah, Tony, I agree. He should have a different name every time, but the same boots in every season.
Treebeard and he should meet, you know, and Treebeard calls him by his name.
Absolutely. Yeah, no, we totally need to have a meeting between Tom Bombadil and Treebeard, maybe in season 3. But yeah, he's got to have his blue jacket and yellow boots from season 1.
The other thing we could do is, you know how the movies do this, I don't know if TVs do this, but, you know, while the credits roll at the end of a show, they'll have, like, a little vignette. So we could have, like, Tom's vignette while the credits roll every episode.
Every episode is Tom Bombadil just, like, skipping down the river path. Yeah, absolutely. Mariel says, does he have to have his blue jacket in every season, or can his fashion style change? Mariel, how about this? How about the cut of his jacket can be different, but it's always blue? Like, he has a blue jacket, but his blue jacket can change over
time. And he doesn't get to have the feather yet, right? That's later.
Yeah, well, different feathers, because he loses his feather and gets different feathers. So, yeah, his style... In fact, the feather in his cap should be different every time. Elaborately different every time. Sometimes it's a little feather, sometimes it's a huge peacock feather, sometimes it's a swan's feather. Tony Mead says, in this season, it's a nightingale feather. Absolutely, Tony.
There you go.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. No, this must happen. There's no question. There's no question about this. But wait a second. So projecting backwards, then, do we need to do a Melian scene in one of the earlier? We could meet her. Oh, remember, weren't we talking about maybe Elway meeting Melian in Lorien during the ambassador time?
Yes, in we episode were. Two? They were kind of hiding each other. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, he noticed her if she doesn't notice him. He's like, right. Whoa.
Right. He can see her. And that, of course, sets it up so that we know, so that the viewers, that's how the viewers know that she's not actually like an evil
Ungoliant. Yeah.
Yeah. Ungoliant figure. Because they will not only have seen her in Valinor, but they will have seen him seeing her. So that when he sees her, it's not like, wow, strange, random, but extremely attractive woman in the woods. Like, this is probably not sketchy. Instead, it will be like, it's her, right? That will be his reaction.
Yes.
Right. His reaction will be, she's here. Oh, my gosh. And like the memory of her has been like haunting him.
Ooh, cool.
Yeah, yeah.
I like it.
Yeah, I like that. Okay. So that's easy enough then to give. That's the cue that we give to the reader back in episode two. Do we want then a scene in episode two? Like not with, you know, obviously Elway's not part of that conversation, doesn't hear anything of it. But in the scene where we have him see Melian, we could have the sort of the narrative shift to Melian and go from there to a conversation she has with some others. Like Gandalf can be one of them too. Aloran can be part of that conversation, and Aloran doesn't want to go. So like she says, I want to go to Middle-earth and hang out, and there can be another spirit, like another whom we don't have to name, who's also wanting to go and to become a little genius loci over there. And Gandalf is there, and you know, thinking about Middle-earth, he's interested in the fate of Middle-earth and he's concerned about it, but he's not going to go. He decides not to go. So then later on, they're going to have to drag him over. It's an obvious question. Should we bring Kuramo in? Or actually, no. I don't want Kuramo involved in that, but I might kind of like Radagast involved with that. We didn't have Radagast before.
That's right.
We only had Gandalf and Saruman. Because Radagast is kind of going to be like, as an Istari, he's going to kind of set up almost like a genius loci, right? In sort of settling down.
Yeah, that's right.
And being, so he can really, really love the idea. Gandalf can be kind of plus minus on the idea, but Radagast is going to really like the idea. But he's going to be like, not yet, right? Iwendil is his name, Tony. Radagast's name in Valinor. Yeah, Radagast needs to be the name that's given to him by the men of the north around Mirkwood. This sort of,
I mean, I could see Kuramo weighing in on it, but it would be more of a, I would want to have my own domain kind of attitude, you know. But I don't know. If we're going to have Radagast be in on it, then I'd say probably not do Kuramo.
Right, because the other thing is I want to make sure we don't give the impression that that Olorin and Kuramo are like attached at the hip in Valinor.
Right. Right. That's true.
They're not like best buddies. But,
they're not best friends. No, yeah, I can't imagine them ever having been best friends.
Exactly. So, but we've already had them together as like joint envoys.
Now I can see Gandalf and Radagast being buddies.
Yeah.
You know, which makes the meeting on the road, you know, in Lord of the Rings much more, you know, mean something more.
Yeah, I mean, to show that they know each other and are connected.
Yeah, and that Gandalf trusts them.
Yeah. Though remember, in the essay on the Istari, he is sent over basically with Saruman.
Right.
You know, Saruman has been saddled with Radagast, basically. You know, Radagast is like his, well, not his third wheel, his second wheel, basically. He's sent over as his like sidekick. And Saruman seems to somewhat despise him from the beginning. But anyway. That's a story from another time. So, okay, yeah. So we have that, we can have that conversation with Melian back in episode 2. That's fine. So she's going, she's going to set up camp at Nan Elmoth. Nan Elmoth, this is going to be the place, right? That she's going to choose, and she's going to set up. Tony says he's like the unwanted partner in the cop show. Yeah, that's exactly the relationship between Radagast and Saruman. Anyway, okay. So she's going to set up in Nan Elmoth. So she's like setting her girdle about it, and she's, and inside, and this is where we can do a really fun contrast with Aeol's later on. Aeol's going to come, and after Aeol comes, Nan Elmoth is going to be a place of darkness, right? But maybe she is making it a place of well, it might be still be dark, but like contemplative Lorien style darkness, right? It will be a, you know, the twilight of nightingales, but it will be beautiful and it will be calm and it will be peaceful. And he comes in. We don't even have to, like, what I would kind of like to do, rather than showing, like, him actually frozen, I think the thing we have to avoid is have him actually frozen, you know, like...
Right.
That's just going to be too ridiculous.
But what we can do is having it, when he crosses, this is the other thing that I really like about having the mini girdle, right? Because once he crosses that frontier, so the frontier itself can be freaky. And he's got to push through it. But then when he gets inside, it's different, right? And there's this clear sense of he is in a totally separate space, which feels like a little, like, pocket dimension. You know, this there can be a... It's a place where it would be easy to believe that, like, time is not functioning in the same way inside as it is on the outside. This, of course, is a thing that we get in we'll get in Lorien later on. This is something that Galadriel picks up from Melian. So that's, all we need is him to go in and make it clear he's crossed into a different world, right? Like Thingol has like gone through the wardrobe. He's in a different place. And then we just cut away to the people looking for him, and the people look for him and they go and they find Nan Elmoth, but they can't go in. They can't and won't go in. And they might even theorize that he did go in and is lost and has clearly died or something. Oh, then all we have to do is show time passing on the outside, and we don't have to like worry about what's going on the inside. All then we need is for Thingol and Melian to come out later on.
Right.
And that a lot of time passes, you know, while he's in there. Yeah, Robert is quoting the description in the published Silmarillion, but yeah, Robert, that's exactly what I think we don't want to actually depict on screen. Standing long years measured by the wheeling stars above them and the trees of Nan... Like, the two of them standing in stasis while the trees are growing around them and the stars are wheeling past is, I think, exactly what we don't want to show on screen. Because, again, as a story, that idea of, like, them passing out of time and, you know... like them kind of encountering each other and, you know, while the world, you know, and having this totally different experience while the world goes past around them is a lovely concept in a story, but I think it would work terribly on screen. And Tony, I agree. He should look different when he comes out. He should be visibly changed when he comes out. As well as his name, of course, being changed. But I think he doesn't come out in this episode. I think we save that at least till the next episode, maybe the episode after. But anyway, he certainly doesn't come out in this episode. Mariel's asking if he can be taller. That would be interesting, actually, if he were in fact taller. Because, of course, we know he is the tallest of all the elves.
Taller than...
He was before.
Oh, you mean as a result of his encounter with Melian? Interesting.
That would be, I mean, we wouldn't want to obviously show it happening, but
That would probably be the most, you know, some kind of physical transformation of that type would sort of be the best way to communicate something, you know, the change that he's gone through.
Yeah, well, it comes out and his hair is silver, so, you know, his hair is going to change. Just like Jonathan Harker, except totally different. Anyway, okay. All right. So I think this works. I'm liking this. Now we need the decision. Olwey and Kirdan. Now we have the second divide, right? Olwey and Kirdan decide to go on. Celeborn, Mablung, Beleg, Dairon, all, you know, the Doriath guys all decide to stay and keep looking for him.
Mm-hmm.
I'm thinking it's the reason Olwey goes on, I think, can be pretty simple. That's the last thing Olwey said, right? Olwey told him to, like, he believes his brother is probably dead, that he's been taken like the others, and he is, and so he's determined to, like, fulfill his brother's vision, you know, his brother's last wish. You know, his brother said, before he left, his brother said, like, you know, bring the people on to Valinor, and he's determined to do that, in order to honor his brother's memory. I don't know that that's enough at the end. Like, you know, we talked about Olwey discovering his purpose. That's not enough, ultimately, for his purpose. But I think that's enough to keep him going. But I do think it would explain... That seems to me satisfying as an explanation of the split. Do you guys think we need more?
No, I think that's enough.
So the Sindar who stay, would we... I mean... How are they mourning? Are they staying because, so like, basically, is the disagreement ultimately between the Sindar and the other and you know, Olwey and Kirdan's folks? Is it like Olwey and Kirdan and their folk are the people who are convinced that Olwey is dead, and the people who are convinced that he's not there, who are at least highly suspicious that he isn't dead, are the ones who decide to stay? Is it just like the ones who like him more and the others are like, well, whatever. I mean, like, you know, it's the desire to stay, the reasons for staying that I'm trying to probe. I'm comfortable with Olwey's decision to move on, to complete his brother's work. I want to make sure that we have a really good explanation of the rationale of the people who are staying, especially, you know, since Celeborn's one of them. We have a first-hand witness who can tell us what their rationale was.
Right.
And yeah, Mariel, because exactly, that's exactly the kind of question I think, you know, Mariel says, should they, those who remain, be angry at the others who are giving up? That's exactly the question. I mean, you know, do we have any dynamic of that kind? Because it's a very natural, I mean, if we really kind of try to think through the psychology of the situation... That's a natural thing, you know. Okay, you bunch of quitters. Like, aren't you gonna?
Right.
He might be alive. You might need our help, you know. If they do find Nan Elmoth and the mini girdle, that itself could be like a mystery that they're trying to solve. And that they, you know, so they believe that he vanished there, and they don't know what's there and why it's there, and so they're going to try to stay to get to the bottom of it. But maybe they don't find that out until after Olwey leaves, because that would be kind of hard to imagine, right? If Olwey's like, so we've tracked my brother down to this like forest, which is terrifying, and nobody can enter into it, and he seems to have vanished in there. Well, all right. Let's just go then. I mean, that's kind of hard to imagine Olwey doing. But basically, if the decision first is those who say, no, we insist on staying and continuing to look, and Olwey saying, if he were coming back, he would have come back by now. If he hasn't come back by now, he's probably been lost like the others were lost in, you know, by Quivienin. Therefore, we should go. So the difference is they want to stay and look, and only after they stay and look do they eventually track down Nan Elmoth. So the finding of Nan Elmoth is like the reward for the people who stay to look. So Celeborn and the others can be like camped out near Nan Elmoth, being like, you know, what do we do? How do we get in there? How do we discover this? And then eventually they emerge. Okay, that I think would work. that I think would work. And so basically it can be, it doesn't have to be acrimony on either side, really. It can be like, but there can be like, you know, strongly differing opinions, right? No, we should stay and search for him, and Olwey, like, with understanding and sadness, says, like, you know, okay, like, you can stay and look if you want, but, you know, I think he is gone, and that we have to, you know, the best we can do is to fulfill his vision for our people.
Carry on his work.
Yeah, yeah. And they can say, yeah, Chris, I like that. They can tell Olwey that they'll catch up. They're not abandoning. Unlike Lenway. Lenway decides to stay. Like, he makes the concrete decision to abandon the journey westward. The Sindar, Celeborn,
right,
and Beleg and them can say, we'll catch up with you, but we're going to stay and look first.
Right.
And they fully intend to go on eventually. And they only, as Chris Graham is suggesting here, they only make the choice not to go when
are we going to see any wistfulness in Celeborn about never having been to Valinor?
Yeah, why not? I mean, I don't think we want him to be all like, well, I never thought Valinor was all that much anyway, and like, probably not worth.
Well, and we also don't want it to be a strong longing, because that wouldn't, you know, he stays after Galadriel leaves, so it's not.
Yes, exactly. So he's clearly tied to Middle Earth. Yeah, he's not pining for it actively and living with the regret, because he's had opportunities to go since then, and and what we see in Celeborn is he's like the last one to go. So, I mean, if anything,
maybe he doesn't. Maybe he doesn't, actually. Maybe he's not that curious about it.
Well, I mean, the simplest thing, as far vis-a-vis the frame, the simplest thing to do is to, again, we've got the question of, like, do elves belong in Valinor, or do elves belong in Middle-earth? The simplest thing to do is to have, not in a black and white, super simplistic way, but Galadriel is the voice of the one, and Celeborn is the voice of the other. You know, Celeborn is the voice of elves belong in Middle-earth, because that's what he's lived his whole life. You know, he makes the decision first to stay to look for Thingol, and then to stay with Thingol. And then he repeatedly makes the choices not to leave after that. Galadriel was born in Valinor. So her sense of do elves belong in Valinor is going to be, you know, her perspective on that question is going to be rather different. It's the place of her birth.
Well, Galadriel's always going to have that era of the exile, right? That's something she never really comes to terms with.
Yes, exile and the guilt associated with being in exile as well. You know, that Valinor is, she still thinks of Valinor as her home and the ultimate place where she should go and would like to be, but she can't go. She's not permitted.
She's banned.
She's banned. And maybe even hasn't forgiven herself. But that's a subject for a later time.
Actually, that'd be a great reason for her to have paired up with Celeborn, because there's no danger. She's assuming she's going to stay in Middle-earth forever.
Yes.
Being married to a guy who's, you know, never been to Valinor is like, okay, that makes sense.
Yes.
I'll just be with him the rest of the day.
So it's part of her, like, it's marriage to Celeborn is like reconciling herself to permanent Middle-earth
staying in Middle-earth.
Exactly.
Anyway, as you say, subject for another day.
Subject for the beginning of season three. The discussion of how are we going to depict Galadriel during the rebellion of the Noldor and the Kinslaying and stuff is going to be super fun. I can't wait for those discussions. But and like Galadriel on the Helcaraxa and everything, it's going to be awesome.
Well, that's really.
I do have
awesome.
One thing I'd like to say, and I think it would be appropriate for the frame here, and I think it'll change the scene of when they meet the Fellowship later on down the line. I would like to actually depict Celeborn and Galadriel as a really tight couple, you know, as a team.
Yes.
That they really do love one another, and they are a team in this, and they're in full communication, and you know what I mean? It's like she's not weak husband that in other words, they really are a team. And I really would like that to be something we establish now, so that when we see them meet the Fellowship later, it'll be a different experience than what we've maybe picked up as readers.
Yes.
You know.
Yes.
Yeah. No, I mean, I think that that would be good. And Chris Graham, I agree, Galadriel fulfills Celeborn's desire to see the light, just as with Thingol and Melian, right? Thingol, who longed to return because he was one of the ambassadors, is satisfied, you know, with the light of Valinor that is still in the face
Very
of Melian. And you know, the parallel, obviously, between Celeborn, Galadriel, and Thingol and Melian is a really strong one, so we can see that same kind of satisfaction.
It's like, I don't need Valinor, I have Galadriel, yay!
So the two of them are content with each other. Like, she has to stay in Middle-earth, and she longs for Valinor, but she is content, and being with Celeborn is both an outward manifestation of her decision to be content with it, but also a source of her content, right? She's happy. Mm-hmm. She's happy with Celeborn here in Middle Earth, even though she does still in her heart long for Valinor.
And that'll make Celeborn's decision to leave in season 50 a lot more poignant.
Oh, yeah. Oh man, the build up for that is going to be awesome. Yeah, absolutely. It's going to be so satisfying when that finally happens.
That'll actually be the final season, you know, exactly. I guess.
Just imagine 30 years from now, you know, like how much people's lives are going to be screwed when they start binge watching this, you know, this film project on Netflix, right?
And other professors will be holding marathons.
Other professors will be holding marathons. They will last for 8 weeks, you know, as they go through the entire thing. Yeah, absolutely. Yep.
Yeah. I'm really anticipating this final season where we're just digging through the appendices looking for anything we can possibly do.
Yeah. Well, Robert Brown says, of course, that'll be right the season before we start the new Shadow. Exactly.
There
the
you
sequel
go.
Tolkien
That's
started
right.
writing.
Well, there's also the aftermath, you know, the show of what Éomer and
we could get another
Aragorn
season or two out of Aragorn's kingship.
Oh, easy,
right? You know, and absolutely, yeah. No reason to rush and end at the Grey Havens with the departure of the Ringbearers. We've got several seasons.
That's right.
Worth of material.
I mean, Celeborn's going to stay on, so we also have that happening.
Absolutely.
You know? So I mean,
absolutely.
He's really the end of the season, or you know, depending. I don't know if he leaves before Aragorn dies or not, but whichever one is left, last man standing.
Because it's not like we've got. It's not like we could possibly end the show without doing the death of Aragorn, right?
Oh, no.
Come on.
Yeah.
That's got to happen. Oh, of course it could happen.
Since now we have an emotional investment in Arwen to see the aftermath that happens to her.
Yeah, exactly.
Right?
Exactly. The death of Arwen, departure of Celeborn.
I guess Celeborn would have left by the time that happened, though.
Isn't the latest recorded event in the appendices is Legolas and Gimli leaving?
Yep,
that's true. That's the end of Appendix A Appendix B. Yeah, yeah.
But is that while Aragorn is still king, or after he dies?
It's after. After.
Oh, okay. So it is the latest.
I think that's the parting shot of the season finale. Just those two guys on like a little tiny little sailing boat. Just the two of them heading out.
Still arguing. How many fish each caught? I got 5 fish.
Still competing. Yeah. How many fish they've caught? That's good. It's just the kind of relationship Gimli and Legolas have. Okay. All right. So, last thing then. We seem to be not getting to the... several people were suggesting that we should not do the arrival of the Noldor and Vanyar in Valinor. That was one of the things that was originally on the outline for this
episode. In this episode, yeah.
And I agree. I think, like, we don't want to have, like... And now, for 2 minutes, let's introduce the elves to Valinor.
Right.
We want to have that be a much more central focus. So I agree. I think we should push the arrival of the Noldor and Vanyar to Valinor back to next time. But... I think we could do the departure of the Noldor and Vanyar on the island, right? So we see them disembarking from Middle-earth and heading off, but then, like, the island vanishes and we don't see them arrive. We see them arrive in the next episode.
Right. I agree.
So this then was my thought. What if Olwë and Círdan see them depart? Now, obviously, we don't want to make it really hokey. We don't want to have them, like, running, panting up to the shore and just missing the boat. You know, like, wait for us. Oh, dang it. You know, like, we don't need... But what if they see them from a distance? You know, what if they're
on top of a mountain which could be recognizable later on in Beleriand, and they're looking out to sea and they see the island departing. Because I would kind of like to get Olwey and Círdan to the shore as well.
Well, and also I would like for Círdan to look down and see the area where he's actually going to be building the havens. Right? It would be like a little inlet or something.
Right, exactly. I want to get him there. We're not going to have his story yet. That's going to be in the next episode. We're going to get the division between Olwey and Círdan and Círdan's decision to stay.
We don't even have to have them arrive on. If you could have him up on a mountain, he could actually just look down and see that inlet.
See the ocean,
and that could be sufficient.
And they see the island leaving. The island is enormous. Right. I mean, the island that Gleif's, it's a very, very big island. Because, like, the island in the Bay of Balar is just a piece of it that broke off, right? We're told. So, Karita says, why not? Just one more in the now honored tradition of person gazing down from a high place shot. It's true. We're very fond of those in film. That actually can be a visual motif, Karita.
That's
I like
true.
It. Let's own it. Let's own it.
And as a sailor, I want to remind you that the Grey Havens should be a secluded bay or a protected bay.
Yes,
or
the
Fallouts
definitely.
Right?
Yes, absolutely. We should have a. They can go. So, but maybe we don't have to. We don't have to have him arriving at the Fallouts or the places that will be the Fallouts until next time.
Right.
But yeah, looking down from a high place where he can see the sea, and they can see the sea from a distance, and they see the island dwindling with the Noldor and the Vanyar on it. So we can have the departure of the Noldor and the Vanyar. They get onto the island and almost start to push it away. Then we cut over to where Olwey and Círdan are watching from a distance and seeing the departure. And we don't even need dialogue. They can just see it. Exactly. Okay. That works. So, in the, 5 minutes we have left, the frame for this time, which we didn't get back to, Celeborn obviously has to be the one who tells the frame for this time. He's in it, right? He's in this story.
Yeah.
He is obviously the speaker here. And I'm not sure... That's as far as I got. I'm not sure what else to do in the frame here. It doesn't feel like...
I don't know that we have to do a lot. You know, we have talked about the fact that the frame doesn't necessarily have to advance every single episode. Right?
Yeah.
Its own story, I mean.
It needn't, necessarily. Well, maybe we can come back to this at the beginning of next time. Since our faithful and industrious readers are going to be making that list of stuff that we want to touch on or do in the frame, and we could be coming to think about that next time. Maybe we can come back and revisit this question of which, if any, of those things are going to fit here in episode 4.
Right.
Especially centered on a Celeborn narration of this. Okay. All right, fine. So I have questions for next time. I have already given you two projects for next time, the list of stuff we want to cover in the frame, plus the list of scenes that we want to give from the bad guys, right, to develop over the course of the season, the Sauron to Myron plot arc and the growth, the eventual arrival of the Necromantic Orc project. In addition to that, I have 5 specific questions. Four. One of my questions was going to be about the bad guys, so I'll save that one. Four specific questions about episode 5. First, what do we emphasize in the arrival to Valinor? So if we're going to do the arrival of the Noldor and Vanyar to Valinor, obviously we've got to make a thing of that. We could even start the episode with that, maybe, I'm thinking. What do we emphasize? What's the theme of that? How does this fit in? We need to be making sure we're doing something, not just having a, isn't Valinor awesome? And they arrive like tourists and are wandering around, taking selfies in Valinor. There has to be some, what do we emphasize about Valinor? How does it fit in with the themes of what we're doing? Especially thinking about this whole,
fear, desire, purpose thing we have going on, the where elves belongs question.
And remember that the Vanyar and Noldor haven't actually made that yet. I mean, they're not, right? They're not, they're still kind of a homogeneous group at this point.
Right.
So how does that happen?
Yeah, we have to settle them down in Tirion together, in Tirion upon Tirion together. So the establishment of their city and so anyway, so we need to think through stuff. We need to think about that. What are we going to do with the arrival to Valinor? Then I want to my next question: how do we depict Círdan and Ossé's relationship? I mean, we know that Ossé and the Teleri get close, right? And great love grows between the Teleri and Ossé, such that some of them decide not to leave him. How does that happen? Especially given also the character of Ossé as we depicted it in season one. How do we make this come about? How do we make this develop? Again, what's their relationship like? Does Círdan take Ossé as a kind of a mentor? Is it like a paternal relationship? You know, what's it like? I don't even know. How are we gonna do that? So that's my clue, because I don't have much of a clue about that. Third, do we have Elwë emerge before or after the rest of the Teleri leave? Do we need to get rid of Elwë and send him off across the sea first, and only then have Elwë emerge? So in other words, do we have Elwë emerge in episode 5 or not? Do we save him for a later episode? Do we have that happen at the end? How do we work that? And fourth, how do we want to connect the Valinor thread with the Teleri thread? So again, we're going to be setting up Tirion and Valinor. We're going to be setting up I guess this is really kind of another version of the first question, really. But how do we want to parallel that? What kind of connection do we want between what's going on in Valinor and what's going on with the Teleri on the shores of Middle-earth? Yeah, so those are my questions for next time. Plus, think about the overall bad guy plot arc and the overall frame plot arc. And we'll come back and hopefully discuss some of those things next time. All right, so that should keep you guys off the streets and out of the pool halls for the next fortnight while we get ready for our next episode. So thanks, everybody. And
see you guys in 2 weeks.
Absolutely. So we will leave it there and say thank you for listening, and Godspeed.